Welcome to the Jazzcast. This is Shannon Gunn, and this is a podcast dedicated to curated listening sessions with jazz musicians. Today, I have Jeff Antoniak from the DC metro area. He plays around with several ensembles, and he also has a very robust education program that he puts on for various people, including a jazz camp. So I'm really excited to have him here today to talk about his music and the background behind it, and also to hear about what projects he has coming up. Before we get started, I just wanted to tell everyone, if you would like to find out when I post a new episode, you can go to my website, which is jazztothebone.com, or follow me on Twitter, which is @jazztothebone, and that's JazzTothebone. Okay, without further ado, Jeff Antoniak, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Well, thank you for carving time out of your extremely busy schedule. I'm sure you're in between tours and just super busy with all the stuff that you're doing. So I really appreciate you taking time to speak to me today on the phone.
Well, I remember we were at a gig or a jam session together months ago, and you mentioned the idea of this podcast, and I was just geeked about it. I think it's, you know, just such a great idea, and I'm glad, you know, a really educated, great player like you is doing it. So I'm really pleased to be here today.
Well, thank you. So usually I just start out and I ask you, can you just go ahead and give us a little background about yourself and where you're from and that sort of thing?
You bet. I'm from Canada, actually, originally. I'm from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And I guess I came to the States years ago to go to the University of North Texas. And at that time, so this is back in the 80s. I don't know if any of your listeners were around in the 80s or not, but I'm like a partially old dude at this point.
No.
At that time, to get a jazz degree, it seems crazy to think about now where every college, you know, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a jazz degree somewhere. Every city has five universities and colleges with a jazz degree. Not that long ago, it was a handful of places in North America. So now that was going back to the 70s, let's say. And there was still, you know, this stigma, is jazz real music? And all the, you know, all the big universities were, you know, that was internal conflict about, are they going to have jazz? Should we keep the jazz musicians separate so they don't infect everyone else? You know, that kind of stuff. And when I was coming up in the mid-80s, that was, things were turning around, but that was still like a real thing. There were a handful of places where people went to study jazz. You know, North Texas, I think it's the first jazz degree in the world, was at North Texas. There was Indiana, where David Baker, you know, these are the guys that invented jazz education, where these guys taught. I think Miami had something, of course, you know, the Berklee School of Music. But it was sort of like the big four or five places that you could go to. And in Canada, there was literally one university way off in Nova Scotia, of all places, you know, one of the islands in the east. And I'm from the west, so I thought, look, if I'm going to fly across the country and move to somewhere where I don't know anyone, let me just fly south and, you know, go to a place I've heard of. So that's sort of how I ended up in North Texas and went for a couple years and stayed for 6 years and got a master's degree there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and so through, I guess the short version of the story is leaving North Texas, I was with a group and we got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which was a nice thing to get when you're leaving school. And so for 4 years, we lived in some rural communities around the U.S. and were artists in residence and taught and recorded and all that stuff. And when that 4 years was over, it was time to move somewhere. And this is the area I moved to. I live specifically in Annapolis. Uh-huh. And so this is sort of my adopted hometown now, the D.C. Baltimore area. And, you know, I've been playing full-time for the, I guess, 17 or so years that I've been here. And, you know, I'm still constantly meeting great musicians and folks who I don't know or names that I've heard and haven't bumped into yet. Mm-hmm. So I feel, you know, even though it's been 17 years, I feel like I'm still you know, meeting new folks and everything. And, you know, so beside the full-time playing, like you mentioned, I sort of fell into adult education, I guess, mm-hmm. specifically. And that's, you know, it's become sort of a neat big part of what I do.
Well, I know you have a lot going on with that, and I'm always impressed with, you know, all the various programs you have set up, master classes and stuff like that, not necessarily associated with a college, which is really cool to see, you know, somebody just putting that kind of stuff together on their own. So.
You know, it's, I did an interview with somebody else recently, and, you know, they asked me, well, how many people are involved, you know, sort of regular, it's not like these are full-time students studying 8 hours a day, but we have about 130 or 140 signed up, committed, full-time jazz students.
That's great.
And, you know, when we did the math, that's more than every jazz program in the area combined. And that was sort of, shocking to me.
I don't want to insult any of the local colleges or universities, but that's still pretty, and it's great that you pull in, you know, the adults, people that are, you know, sort of in their working, maybe they're ready to retire, or, you know, they all have day jobs and they just want to learn. And I think that's wonderful to pull all those people
in. And that's exactly it. You know, this all started, we're actually in our 10th anniversary of Maryland Summer Jazz, our summer workshop. But this all started where, you know, I had a couple students who were adult folks with day jobs, and, you know, they got to the point where they were sounding pretty good, and it was time for them to start playing in a group setting to really continue to grow. And there wasn't really anything to recommend. At that time, there weren't any good jam sessions in town. And if there was something, it was in a, you know, a weird night of the week at 10 p.m., you know, something that just wasn't going to work for them. So, you know, I put together a combo of sort of adult amateur folks and, you know, for a one-time thing. And they enjoyed it. Hey, let's do this again. And over the years, one led to two, and two led to five, and so now we have 14 full-time jazz small groups that that adult musicians in the area come to. And folks come from as far away as Delaware and Philadelphia.
Wow.
Like, you know, really driving way further than I would expect, because this kind of thing, I guess, just doesn't exist in many other cities.
Yeah, that's great. You have that going.
Yeah, so we call it Jazz Band Masterclass. So if any of your listeners are interested, jazzbandmasterclass.com is where we're at, and we always have openings for, you know, pretty much any instrument you can imagine. We have flute players and violin players and vocalists involved in a jazz choir that we do. So yeah, there's quite a bit of option.
Cool. Well, I can attest to the fact that you get excellent faculty. And you have a heart for teaching. And
so I love it. I really do.
I'm glad to see it. Okay, well, do you have any songs that you'd like us to listen to today?
Well, yeah. You know, I was looking back at a couple of the albums that I've done recently. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to have two really great groups that are, you know, sort of different from their point of departure, I guess. A group of mine called the Jazz Update. You know, some of my favorite players in town. And I must say, D.C. is an embarrassment of riches as far as the musicians we have, isn't it?
It is so, like, the quality is just so high. I agree. I really feel like there's a great jazz community in this town.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived in, you know, some other major cities around North America that are, you know, cities of a million or more. And, yeah, it's just so deep on every instrument. So, you know, when I say the best players in town, there's a lot of best players in town. But, you know, some really, you know, some of the traditional names like Tony Martucci on drums,
yeah.
Tom Baldwin on bass, who teaches at the University of Maryland as well. So anyway, it's a great group called the Jazz Update, and we've got a couple albums out, and it was nice that both those albums, you know, charted on the Jazz Top 50 and everything when they were released. So our most recent album is called Brotherhood, and the first song on the album I like for a couple reasons. One is I wrote it for my son, and I guess he was about 8 years old when I wrote it. And anyone that's been around an eight-year-old boy, there's a good chance there's a lot of energy involved in what you are seeing. So yeah, he and I have so much fun together, and he's just a goofy little kid, and one of my many socially acceptable nicknames for him is Screwball.
So you wrote this for your son?
Screwball is written
so
for
great.
My son, and you know, I really sat down to try to capture that sort of off-kilter, anything could happen, eight-year-old energy.
All right. Well, that's great. I'm, like I said, I was really surprised to hear that you wrote it for your son. I had no idea. So I just think that's really cool. And, do you want to tell us anything else about this piece of music, how it came about, or anything musical that you, thought was interesting about how you put it together?
Well, you know, more and more I'm trying to, geez, how do you say this? I guess, connect emotionally with music, which sounds like a ridiculous thing to say. Music isn't, that's what it's about. It's about emotion. It's about, you know, it's an art form. It's about that. But I think as so many people that do an art know, there's so much mechanics behind it. There's so much science, whether it's music or photography or cooking or whatever. It's easy to get wrapped up in the mechanics and the theory. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes forget that this is supposed to be about expression or, you know, letting those emotions go. Sometimes someone who calls themselves an emotional player, oh yeah, he's feeling it, is not always the best musician. Pure emotion with no technique, that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Right? So I find myself getting wrapped up in theory because I love theory. I love talking about it. I love teaching it. So, you know, sometimes as I'm playing, I'm starting to tell myself, look, forget all that stuff. Connect to a thought. Connect to a feeling. So when I was writing the song, I actually remember I was teaching at Towson University up in Baltimore, and one of my students didn't show up, and I had an hour to kill. And I thought, well, let me try to write something. And I thought, before I put my hands on the piano, have an idea. What, you know, what am I trying to express? As opposed to, you know, I just wanted to take sort of a different approach. So I remember thinking about my son and thinking, well, okay, that's good. What about my son? And this positive, happy, okay, it needs to be happy. It needs to be energetic. It needs to be quirky. You know, but I don't want it to be just another jazz song in a major key. So, I remember sort of going back and forth with wondering, well, what does quirky mean? What does that mean in a jazz song? So yeah. Some odd time signatures had to be in there, or that's what I was hearing. I remember wanting the audience to not know where the downbeat was going to come, where the next important part of the form was going to come. So, of course, now I'm not thinking emotionally. I'm thinking structurally and compositionally. But I remember catching myself and keep going back to, the emotion of what I'm trying to achieve, as opposed to getting lost in the woods with all the mechanical stuff. So it was. I remember it being a fun tune to write because I kept sort of bouncing back and forth and. Wanting this emotion to come through. And it ended up being a very, I'm really happy with the song. I'm glad it made the cut for the album and everything. And, I think it was a good lesson to me to be balancing how I think about music.
Wow, that's so cool. I'm very thankful you told us that because, you know, I agree with that 100%. And I just think that it's really interesting, that kind of balance between theory and emotion and just trying to use the theory as a tool, but not necessarily as a means to an end.
Exactly. You know, I'm sure you've had this happen too, Shannon, where you're on a gig and you play a solo and, you know, some non-musician comes up and goes, oh, it must be so awesome. You just express your heart for a living. How cool is that? And in your mind, you're thinking, no,
actually,
I was
yeah.
busy worrying about the tritone sub and the seventh measure and how I was going to modulate to the key of B at the bridge. And, you know,
it does get very technical. It does.
It really does. And of course, people's outside imagination of what it's like to be a jazz musician or a movie star or whatever, as opposed to what's really going on behind the scenes. It's, you know, there's a disconnect there.
I agree. I think that's really interesting. That's sort of one of the things I like to talk to people about is, you know, what are you thinking when you solo? So some people think in tonality, some people think kind of micromanaging, some people think in scales, some people think in vocabulary, and some people think, like you say, in pure emotion. And so I just think it's really interesting to talk about this. It's neat.
Oh, it's great stuff. I love when I get to, you know, sit down with, you know, people like you, my friends who I respect their playing, because, you know, we spend so much time talking about other stuff on the break.
Yeah.
We're not really talking about the music lots of times. So, yeah, I love this kind of stuff too.
Me too. Okay. Well, I think you mentioned that. Did you have Tom Baldwin and Tony Martucci on this?
Right. You heard them. And, of course, a great piano player who's been one of the top call guys in D.C. for years, Wade Beach.
Okay. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and Wade teaches at George Mason, so I'm sure you bumped into him there once or twice.
Yeah.
This is just a fantastic, fantastic group of musicians. And I have one other quick question, and that is, where did you guys get this recorded?
Yeah, that's a funny story. We were going to record a really great jazz recordist, if that's the right word, is a guy named Richard Roeder, sort of an old-school Baltimore guy, and he had a studio up north of Baltimore, and for years that's where many of the really good sort of D.C. guys, D.C. Baltimore guys would go to get recorded. That's where we did our first album, and so we had time booked with him there, and he... I think the story was a raccoon got into the ceiling of his studio and died. And it got so bad that he had to actually gut the studio because of the smell and the whatever. So, I know. So this is literally 4 days before our recording. And, of course, all these very busy guys, you know, it was impossible to find a couple days where we could record. Somehow we got it done months in advance. So we were really, you know, a little bit up a creek without a paddle because we didn't have a recording studio anymore. All the places in D.C. were booked. So I think Tony and I were at Blues Alley and sort of commiserating out loud. It's like, oh, man, where are we going to record in 2 days, blah, blah. And I think Steve Novosel, great bass player, somebody overheard us and said, oh, you need to go out to Pennsylvania at this place called Red Rock Recording.
Uh-huh.
We heard about this place, went up there. Well, it turns out Dave Liebman lives half a mile down the road.
Wow.
Phil Woods lives 4 miles down the road.
Oh, cool.
So it's in this Delaware Water Gap area. So Liebman's done his last, I think, 22 albums there.
Oh, my gosh.
Phil Woods records there all the time. Literally, when we were recording, Liebman walked in the door to pick up a tape or something. Almost gave me a heart attack. Because that's the last thing I need is Dave Liebman standing there when I'm recording a solo. So anyway,
cool.
So it was this you know, sort of happy accident that we you know, found a really, really great recording studio. You know, it sounds like far away, but it wasn't that bad. It was very affordable. The guy was incredibly quick, so you know, so the cost of making the recording you know, actually sort of went down just because how well he knew jazz and how well he knew a studio. Everything just flew by.
Great. Wonderful. That's so cool. I had no idea. We'll have to check that out, Red Rock.
It's a great place.
Link up to that. Okay. All right. Well, do you have any other tunes that you'd like us to listen to?
Well, yeah. I have a new group that sort of fell together, I guess, a year or two ago called the Mars Quartet. And Mars is actually an acronym for our last names. Max Murray is the M in Mars, and he's a bassist, and he won a Latin Jazz Grammy a couple years ago, and nominated for a Grammy. So he comes with some good bio material.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the A in Mars. Frank Russo is the R in Mars, a great drummer who I used to teach with up at Towson University, and Donato Soviero, one of the really great guitar players in town in D.C., is the S in Mars. So we started playing together just to cover a gig, I think it was, and enjoyed playing together. We started playing together more. And through no real planning, we found ourselves sort of gravitating towards, we don't even know what to call it, newer jazz. I think, you know, if you and I were on a gig tomorrow night with a great rhythm section in town, I imagine we might play a lot of sort of great American songbook material.
Mm-hmm.
Or we might call a Monk tune, or a Coltrane tune, or a Benny Golson tune. Mm-hmm. And that's what most jazz gigs end up being. It's either that or original music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all that great jazz from the 40s through the, let's call it, 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of what a lot of us call jazz without really thinking about it, or songs we wrote in the last 3 years. But there's all that stuff from the late 60s to today that doesn't get played a lot. One is because it's not I don't want to use the word formulaic, but, you know, that is what the Great American Songbook is. It's the blues or it's 32 bar forms. It's a bridge that goes to the key of four, et cetera, et cetera. Those are easy
right.
songs to fake, easy songs to memorize. But a Keith Jarrett tune from his European quartet in 1973, you can't fake that. That's something you need to rehearse. So there's all this great music, Weather Report and John Scofield and Pat Metheny. And, you know, we could just name names of music that we love and grew up listening to, but we don't get to play very often.
Yeah.
So we sort of found ourselves gravitating towards that sort of those couple missing decades of jazz that just don't get played too much, partly because it just requires some rehearsal. It's not so impossibly hard, but it really will take four or five rehearsals to get one of those songs properly together.
Wow.
So anyway, so the Mars Quartet, we just sort of found ourselves gravitating to that music and writing songs in that style. So it's a neat project. And we're also sort of interested, as a lot of other groups are, in going back and taking some of the great rock or funk music and sort of reinterpreting that in a jazz kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
So on the new CD, there's some Led Zeppelin and, you know, stuff like that. So it's a pretty cool group. And there's a little bit of sort of an electric vibe to it, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm messing around with effect pedals on my horn, which I've been experimenting with pretty seriously for a year now. So it's neat. There's a lot of sort of new fertile ground for me to think about in that group.
Cool. Which song do you want us to hear from them?
Let's hear The Blind Watchmaker.
Thank you.
Okay, awesome. And so can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Sure. Yeah, this tune was actually, the title is stolen from a book that I had read by an evolutionary biologist named Richard Dawkins. He's sort of got a name out there, and every once in a while he goes on TV and says something crazy, so people know his name a little bit. But it was a book that I'd heard about for years and wanted to read. And so anyway, I think this is one of those songs where I just sort of sat down at the piano and a repetitive bass ostinato came out, and I just sort of followed the song along. And it's, you know, it's not a traditional 32-bar tune. You know, so it is somehow a modern jazz tune. You know, I wrote it on the piano when I brought it into the Mars Quartet and heard Donato playing it on guitar. It reminded me of a Police tune. It reminded me of like some early Police. You know, Donato was playing, had a chorus sound on the guitar, and the more I listened to it, it's like, wow, this, you know, I'd like to hear Sting sing on this tune.
Awesome.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a sort of more modern, you know, modern non-swinging kind of jazz, I guess.
Where did you get this recorded?
This one was recorded in New Jersey by a guy named Paul Wycliffe. Mm-hmm. And both Max Murray and Frank Russo had done some recording with him. His studio is called Skyline.
Oh.
And he's, you know, just outside New York. I don't know what it is, maybe it's 30 miles or something like that. And again, you know, this is someone who really knows what jazz sounded like. Back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I think he had the... Really, I think it was the biggest studio in New York aside from Columbia. So,
wow.
You know, he was doing all the major, you know, rock stuff and all the big jazz stuff. And, you know, just eventually downsized. But again, he really knows what jazz sounds like. I think the day before we came in to record the album, Kenny Barron had just done his new trio album.
Wow.
With Paul. So, you know, he works with all the best players and, you know, again, just very, you know, very quick and really knows what the music sounds like. So it was great working with him.
Okay, well, this concludes part one of the interview with Jeff Antoniak. I'm going to be posting part two tomorrow, which includes additional music that he wanted us to hear and him talking about it. So please check back to jazztothebone.com or subscribe to this podcast in iTunes, or you can follow me on Twitter at jazztothebone, and you'll see when I post the next episode. Thanks so much for listening, and bye.